She should just throw the journey book in a fire, destroy it. Let the prelate try to use her then. Let her see that Verna was finished with being played for a fool. See how she liked having her wishes disregarded. It would serve her right. That was what she should have done, but she hadn't. She still had the book tucked in her belt. Despite her hurt, she was still a sister. She had to be sure. The prelate still hadn't proved to her that she was really alive, and had the other book. When she was sure, then Verna would throw the book in the fire. Verna stopped pacing and looked out through one of the windows in the gable ends. The moon was up. This time there would be no grace if her instructions weren't followed. She vowed that either the prelate did as requested and prove her identity, or Verna was going to burn the book. This was the prelate's last chance. Verna pulled the branched candlestick away from the small altar, draped with a white cloth trimmed in gold thread, and set it beside the little table. The perforated bowl, in which Verna had found the journey book in the first place, set atop the white cloth on the altar. Instead of the journey book, it now held a small flame. If the prelate failed again to do as instructed, the journey book was going back into that bowl, into the flames. She pulled the small black book from its pouch in her belt and set it on the little table as she pulled the three-legged stool close. Verna kissed the prelate's ring on her ring finger, took a deep breath, said a prayer beseeching the Creator's guidance, and opened the book. There was a message. Pages of it, in fact. "My dearest Verna," it began. Verna pursed her lips. Dearest Verna, indeed. "My dearest Verna, first, the easy part. I asked you to go to the sanctuary because of the dangers involved. We cannot take any chances that others will read my messages, much less discover that Nathan and I are alive. The sanctuary is the only place I could be sure no one else would read this, and that is the only reason I failed to follow your reasonable precaution before now. You, of course, should expect me to prove myself. Now that I can be sure that you are alone and safe from discovery, I will provide the proof. In accordance with this caution of only using the sanctuary to communicate, you must be sure to erase all messages before you leave the protection of the sanctuary. Before I go on, the proof. As you requested, this is what I told you in my office the first time I saw you after you returned from your journey to recover Richard. I chose you, Verna, because you were far down on the list, and because, all in all, you are quite unremarkable. I doubted you were one of them. You are a person of little note. I'm sure Grace and Elizabeth made their way to the top of the list because whoever directs the Sisters of the Dark considered them expendable. I direct the Sisters of the Light. I chose you for the same reason. There are sisters who are valuable to our cause. I could not risk one of them on such a task. The boy may prove of value to us, but he is not as important as other matters at the palace. It was simply an opportunity I thought to take. If there had been trouble and none of you made it back, well, I'm sure you can understand that a general would not want to lose his best troops on a low-priority mission. Verna turned the book over on the table and put her face in her hands. There was no doubt it was Prelate Annalena who had the other journey book. She was alive, as probably was Nathan. She glanced to the little fire burning in the bowl. The hurt of those words burned in her chest. Reluctantly, with trembling fingers, she turned the book back over and read on. "Verna, I know that those words must have broken your heart to hear. I do know that it broke my heart to say them, because they were not true. It must seem to you that you are being used in a nefarious way. It is wrong to lie, but it is worse to let the wicked triumph because you adhere to the truth at the expense of good sense. If the Sisters of the Dark were to ask me what my plans were, I would lie. To do otherwise is to allow wickedness to triumph. I will now tell you the truth, realizing that you have no reason to believe that this time my words are true. But I believe in your intelligence, and know that if you weigh my words, you will be able to see the truth in them. The true reason I chose you to go after Richard is because of all the sisters, you were the one I trusted with the fate of the world. You know now the battle Richard won against the Keeper. Without him, we would have all been lost to the world of the dead. A low-priority mission it was not. It was the most important journey any sister had ever been sent on. I trusted only you. Over 300 years before you were born, Nathan warned me of the danger to the world of life. 500 years before Richard was born, Nathan and I knew that a war wizard would come into this world. Prophecies told us some of what must be accomplished. The challenge was unlike any we have faced before. When Richard was born, Nathan and I traveled by ship around the Great Barrier to the New World. We recovered a book of magic from the Wizard's Keep in Adendrill to keep it out of Darkin Rall's hands, and gave the book to Richard's stepfather, securing his promise that he would make Richard learn it. Only through such trials and events in his life at his home could this young man be forged into the kind of person with the wits to stop the first threat, Darkin Rall, his real father, and later restore the balance to the world of life. He is perhaps the most important person born in the last 3,000 years. Richard is the war wizard who will lead us in the final battle. The prophecies tell us this, but not whether we will prevail. This is now a battle for mankind. Our only chance was to make sure, above all else, that he was not tainted in his training as a man. In this battle, magic is needed, but heart must rule it. I sent you to bring him to the palace, because you were the only one I could trust to accomplish the task. I knew your heart and soul, and I knew you were no sister of the dark. I'm sure you are now wondering how I could let you search for him for more than 20 years, when I knew where he was all the time. I also could have waited and sent you after him when he was grown, and at last revealed his whereabouts when he triggered his gift. I am ashamed to admit that I was using you too, much as I used Richard. For the challenges that lie ahead, I needed to teach you things you could not learn at the Palace of the Prophets, while Richard grew and learned some of the essential things he required. I needed you to be able to use your wits, and not the reams of rules that the sisters at the palace thrive on. I had to let you develop your innate skills in the real world. The battle ahead lies in the real world. The cloistered world of the palace is no place to learn about life. I don't expect you to ever forgive me. That, too, is one of the burdens a prelate must bear, the hatred of one she loves like her own daughter. When I told you those awful words, that, too, was to a purpose. I had to finally break you of the palace's teaching that you must always do as you were trained and blindly follow orders. I had to make you angry enough to do what you judged was right. Since you were little, I could always count on your temper. I couldn't trust that if I told you the reasons, you would understand, or do as was necessary. Sometimes a person can only properly affect events by using their own moral propriety, and not by carrying out orders. It is so stated in prophecy. I trusted that you would choose right over training if you came to the conclusion yourself. The other reason I told you those things in my office was because I suspected that one of my administrators was a sister of the dark. I knew my shield would not keep my words from her ears. I let my words betray me, so she would attack me and force their hand. I knew I could very possibly be killed, but I chose that fate over the possibility of the world being plunged into the grip of the Keeper. Sometimes a prelate must even use herself. So far, Verna, you have lived up to my every expectation of you. You have played a vital role in saving the world from the Keeper. With your help, we have thus far succeeded. The very first time I laid eyes on you, I smiled, because you had an angry scowl on your face. Do you remember why? I will tell you if you don't. Every novice brought to the palace was given a test. Sooner or later, we wrongly blamed her for a small offense, of which she was innocent. Most cried, some pouted, some bore the shame of guilt with stoic resignation. Only you became angry at the injustice. In that, you proved yourself. Nathan had found a prophecy that said the one we needed would be delivered to us not with a smile or a pout or a brave face, but with an angry scowl. When I saw that look on your face and your little arms folded in a fit, I nearly laughed aloud. At last, you had been delivered into our hands. From that day, I have been using you in the Creator's most important work. I chose you to be the prelate in the illusion of my death, because you are still the one sister I trust above all others. There is more than a good chance that I will be killed on my present journey with Nathan. And if I do die, you will be the prelate for real. That is the way I wish it. Your justifiable hatred weighs on my heart, but it is the Creator's forgiveness that is important, and I know I will have that much at least. I will suffer your scorn as my burden in this life, as I suffer other burdens for which there is no relief. It is the price of being prelate of the Palace of the Prophets. Verna pushed the book away, unable to read more of the words. Her head fell to her folded arms as she sobbed. Though she didn't recall the nature of the injustice of which the prelate spoke, she remembered the sting of it and her anger. Mostly she remembered the prelate's smile and how it made the world right again.
Oh, dear Creator," Verna wept aloud. "You truly have a fool for a servant."
If she had felt heartache before for thinking the prelate had used her, she now felt agony over the anguish the prelate had had to endure. When she was finally able to bring her tears to a halt, she pulled the little book back before her and read on. "But the past is past, and we must now go on with what must be done. The prophecies say that the greatest danger now lies before us. The tests that have come before would have ended the world of life in a final terrible flash. In an instant, all would be irrecoverably lost. Richard passed those tests and kept us from that fate. Now a greater trial is upon us. It is not from other worlds, but from our own. This is a battle for the future of our world, future of mankind, and the future of magic. In this, in the struggle for the minds and hearts of men, there is no final flash, no instant end, but the inexorable grinding struggle of war, as the shadow of enslavement slowly creeps across the world and darkens the spark of magic, through which comes the Creator's light. The ancient war, started thousands of years ago, is again aflame. We, in protecting this world from others, have unavoidably brought it to pass. This time there will be no cessation of war because of the efforts of hundreds of wizards. This time, we have only one war wizard to lead us, Richard. I cannot tell you all of it now. Some I simply do not know. And as much as it pains me to have to leave you in the dark about some things I do know, understand that because of forks in prophecies that must be correctly taken, it is necessary that some of the people involved act instinctively and not by instruction. To do otherwise would make the correct forks impassable. Part of our job is to hope to teach people to act in the right way, so that when the test comes, they will do what must be done. Forgive me, Verna, but I must once again trust some things to the fates. I hope that you are learning, as prelate, that you cannot always explain everything to others, but that you must sometimes simply give them a task and expect them to do it. Verna sighed. She knew the truth of that. She herself had given up on trying to explain everything all the time, and had started to simply ask that instructions be carried out as spoken. "Some things, though, I can and must tell you, so you can help us. Nathan and I have gone on a mission of vital importance, for now only he and I can know its nature. Should I live, I intend to return to the palace. Before then, you must find out who are loyal sisters of the light, novices and young men. You must also identify all who have given their souls to the Keeper."
"What?"
Verna heard herself say aloud.
"How can I do that?"
"I leave it up to you to find a way. You don't have a lot of time. This is important, Verna. It must be before Emperor Jagang arrives. Nathan and I believe Jagang is what was called in the ancient war a dream walker." Verna felt the sweat between her shoulder blades trickle down her spine. She recalled her talk with Sister Simona, and how the woman had screamed uncontrollably at the mere mention of Jagang's name. Sister Simona said that Jagang came to her in her dreams. Everyone thought Sister Simona was crazy. Warren, too, had spoken of the Dreamwalker, and that in the old war they were a form of weapon. Their visit to Sister Simona had confirmed what he believed.
"Above all else, remember this. No matter what happens, your only salvation is to remain loyal to Richard. A dreamwalker can take just about anyone's mind and enslave them to his will, those with the gift more so than others. There is only one protection, Richard. An ancestor of his created a magic that protects them and any loyal to them, bonded in cause to them, from the power of the dreamwalkers. This magic is passed down to any Rawl born with the gift. Nathan, of course, has this same protective element to his gift, but he is not the one who can lead us. He is a prophet, and not a war wizard."
Verna could read between the lines that being a loyal follower of Nathan would be madness. The man was lightning itself in a collar.
"By going against palace law of your own free will and helping Richard escape, you became bonded to him. This bond protects you from the power of the Dreamwalker, but not from his waking force of arms and minions. This is part of the reason I had to deceive you that day in my office. It made you of your own free will choose to help Richard over your training and orders."
Goosebumps ran up Verna's arms. Had she convinced the prelate to reveal her plans, telling Verna to help Richard escape, then she would have been as vulnerable as Sister Simona to the Dreamwalker.
"Nathan is protected, of course, and I have been bonded to Richard for a good long time. I pledged myself to him when I first saw him. In my own way, I have been letting him set his own rules as to how he fights for our side. At times, I must tell you, it is difficult. Though he does as is needed to protect the innocent, free people who need his help, he has a mind of his own and does things that, if I had my way, he would not do. At times he can be as much of a trial as Nathan. Such is life. I am finished telling you what I had to reveal. I am sitting here in a room in a cozy inn, waiting for you to read this. When you have read this message over as many times as you wish, I'll be waiting here should you wish to ask me anything. You must understand that I have had hundreds of years working at events and prophecies, and there is no way I can impart all that knowledge to you in one night, much less in a journey book. But I will tell you what I can of what you wish to know. Also, you must understand that there are certain things I cannot tell you for fear of tainting prophecy and events. Every word I tell you carries a danger of that, though some more than others. But it is necessary that you know some of it. With these things in mind, I await your questions. Ask. Verna sat up straight at the end of the writing. Ask. It would take 100 years to ask all she wanted to know. Where was she to start? Dear Creator, what were the important questions? She read the entire message again, to be sure she hadn't missed anything, and then sat, staring at the blank page beyond. Finally, she picked up the stylus. My dearest mother, I beg you forgive me the things I thought of you. I am humbled by your strength and shamed by my foolish pride. Please don't get yourself killed. I am not worthy to be prelate. I am an ox that you are asking to soar like a bird. Verna sat, watching the book for the return message to appear if the prelate really was waiting. Thank you, child. You have lightened my heart. Ask what you need to know, and if I can, I will answer your questions. I will sit here all night if I can help you with your burden. Verna smiled for the first time in days. This time the tears were sweet and not bitter. Prelate, are you truly safe? Is everything well with you and Nathan? Verna, perhaps you enjoy having your friends call you prelate, but I do not. Please call me by my name, as all my true friends do. Verna laughed out loud. She, too, was frustrated that people insisted on calling her prelate. Words continued to appear as Anne's message went on. And yes, I am fine, as is Nathan, who is presently occupied. Today he bought himself a sword, and is now having a sword fight with invisible enemies in our room. He thinks a sword will make him look dashing. He is a 1,000-year-old child, and at this moment is grinning like a child as he lops the heads off his invisible foes. Verna read the message again, just to be sure she was reading it right. Nathan with a sword? The man was even more deranged than she had thought. The prelate must have her hands full. Anne, you said I must find out who are sworn to the Keeper. I have no idea how to do this. Can you help? If I knew how to do it, Verna, I would tell you. A few made me suspect them, but most did not. I was never able to find a way to divine who were the Keepers. I have other matters I must deal with, so I must leave this one to you to solve. Keep in mind that they can be as clever as the Keeper himself. Some, who I was certain were against us because of their disagreeable nature, were loyal to us. Some who revealed themselves and escaped on the ship, I would have trusted with my life. I would be dead now, had I. Anne, I don't know how to do this. What if I fail? You must not fail. Verna wiped her sweaty palms on her dress. But even if I can find a way to identify them, then what am I to do with this information? I cannot fight sisters with the power they have. Once you accomplish the first part, Verna, I will tell you. Know that the prophecies are vulnerable to tampering and in danger, just as Nathan and I use them to help us influence events so as to take the proper fork, so too can our enemies use them. Verna sighed in frustration. How can I work to identify our enemies when there is so much work to do as prelate? All I do is read reports, and yet I fall farther and farther behind. Everyone is depending on me and waiting on me. How did you find the time to accomplish anything with all the reports? You read the reports. My goodness, Verna, but you are ambitious. You certainly are more conscientious as prelate than I. Verna's mouth dropped open. You mean that I don't have to read the reports? Well, Verna, look at the value in reading them. Because you read the reports, you discovered that the horses were missing from the stables. We could have easily bought horses after we left the palace, but took those instead so as to leave a sign. We could have paid for the bodies instead of going through the complicated arrangements we did, but then you wouldn't have been able to talk to the gravedigger. We took care to leave signs you could follow so as to discover the truth. Some of the signs we left were quite troublesome, such as the one with the discovery of our bodies, but were necessary, and you did a good job in figuring it out.
Verna felt her face flush. She had never thought to look into the matter of the bodies being discovered already prepared and in winding sheets. She had completely missed that clue.
"But I must confess," Anne went on, "that I hardly ever bothered to read reports. That is what assistants are for. I simply told them that they were to use their judgment and wisdom, and, in keeping with the best interests of the palace, handle the matters involved in the reports. Then every once in a while I would stop before them and pull out some reports that they had dealt with, and read their disposition. It always kept them diligent in their task, for fear I would read their instructions given in my name and find them unsatisfactory."
Verna was astonished.
"You mean to say that I can simply tell my assistants or advisers how I wish matters managed, and then have them handle the reports? I don't have to read them all. I don't have to initial them all."
"Verna, you are prelate. You can do as you wish. You run the palace. It does not run you."
"But sisters Leoma and Philippa, my advisors, and Dulcinea, one of my administrators, all told me how it must be done. They are so much more experienced than I. They made it seem I would be failing the palace were I not to handle the reports myself."
"Did they now?" Anne wrote almost instantly. "My, my, I think that if I were you, Verna, I would do a bit less listening and a little more talking. You have a fine scowl. Use it."
Verna grinned at that. Already she was picturing the scene. There were going to be some changes in the prelate's office come morning.
"Anne, what is your mission? What are you trying to accomplish?"
"I have a small task in Aidendrill, and then I hope to return."
It was plain that Anne wasn't going to tell her, so Verna thought about what else she wanted to know, and what she needed to tell the prelate. One thing of importance came to mind.
"Warren gave a prophecy. His first," he said.
There was a long pause. Verna waited. When the message finally came, its hand was a bit more carefully drawn.
"Do you remember it, word for word?"
Verna could not forget a word of that prophecy.
"Yes."
Before Verna could begin to write the prophecy, a message suddenly began to splash across the page. The scrawl was huge and angry, the letters drawn in big blocks.
"Get that boy out of the palace! Get him out!"
A line snaked across the page. Verna sat up straighter. It was obvious that Nathan had taken the stylus away from Anne and had written the message, and Anne was in the process of getting it back. There was another long pause, and at last Anne's handwriting appeared again.
"Sorry, Verna. If you are certain that you remember the prophecy word for word, then write it down so we may see it. If you are unsure of any of it, tell me. This is important."
"I remember it word for word, as it pertains to me," Verna wrote.
"It says, when the prelate and the prophet are given to the light in a sacred rite, the flames will bring to boil a cauldron of guile and give ascension to a false prelate who will reign over the death of the palace of the prophets. To the north, the one bonded to the blade will abandon it for the silver sliff, for he will breathe her back to life, and she will deliver him into the arms of the wicked."
There was another pause.
"Hold, please, while Nathan and I study this."
Verna sat and waited. The bugs outside chirped and the frogs peeped. Verna stood, keeping an eye to the book, and stretched her back as she yawned. Still there was no message. She sat and rested her chin in her fist, and her eyes drooped as she waited. At last a message began to appear.
"Nathan and I have been going over this, and Nathan says that it is an immature prophecy, and because of that he cannot fully decipher it. Anne, I am the false prelate. It troubles me greatly that this prophecy says I will reign over the death of the palace."
An immediate message came back.
"You are not the false prelate in this prophecy."
"Then what does it mean?" There was a shorter pause this time.
"We do not know its full meaning, but we do know that you are not the false prelate named in it." "Verna, listen carefully. Warren must leave the palace. It is too dangerous for him to remain any longer. He must go into hiding. He could be seen leaving in the night. Tomorrow morning, have him go into the city on the pretense of an errand. In the confusion of people, it will be hard for anyone to follow him. Have him get away through that confusion. Give him gold, so he will not have any trouble doing what he needs."
Verna put a hand to her heart as she gulped a breath. She bent back over the book.
"But, prelate, Warren is the only one I can trust. I need him. I don't know the prophecies like he does, and will be lost without him."
She left unsaid that he was her only friend, the only friend she could trust.
"Verna, the prophecies are in danger. If they get their hands on a prophet..."
The hastily scribbled message halted abruptly.
After a moment, it resumed, more carefully written.
He must get away. Do you understand?
Yes, prelate. I will see to it first thing in the morning. Warren will do as I ask. I will trust in your instructions, that it is more important for him to leave than to aid me.
Thank you, Verna.
Anne, what is the danger to the prophecies? She waited a moment in the quiet of the sanctuary until the writing began again.
Just as we try to help our effort by knowing the danger down various forks in prophecy, so too can those who wish to rule mankind use this information to guide events down forks they want to come to pass. Used in this fashion, the prophecies can defeat us. If they have a prophet, they can have a better understanding of the prophecies and how to direct events to their advantage. Tampering with forks can invoke chaos that even they don't expect and can't control. This is dangerous in the extreme. They could inadvertently walk us all off a cliff.
Anne, are you saying that Jigang is going to try to take the palace of the prophets and the prophecies in the vaults?
Pause. Yes.
Verna paused herself. The realization of the nature of the struggle ahead came over her in icy goosebumps.
How can we stop him? The palace of the prophets cannot fall so easily as Jigang thinks. Though he is a dreamwalker, we have control of our Han. That power is also a weapon. Though we have always used our gift to preserve life and help bring the Creator's light to the world, a time may come when we have to use our gift to fight. For this, we must know who is loyal to us. You must find out who is untainted.
Verna thought carefully before she began to write.
Anne, do you intend to call upon us to become warriors, to use our gift to strike down the Creator's children? I am telling you, Verna, that you will have to use what you know to help prevent the world from being taken forever into the darkness of tyranny. Though we struggle to help the Creator's children, we also carry a Dakra, don't we? We can't help people if we are dead.
Verna rubbed her thighs when she realized they were trembling. She had killed people, and the prelate knew it. She had killed Jedediah. She wished she had brought something to drink. Her throat felt as if it were turning dry as dust.
I understand, she wrote at last. I will do what I must. I wish I could give you better guidance, Verna, but right now I don't know enough. Events are already rushing ahead in a torrent. Without direction, and probably on sheer instinct, Richard has already taken precipitous action. We are not sure what he is up to, but from what I gather, he already has the Midlands in an uproar. The boy doesn't rest for a minute. He seems to make up his own rules as he goes.
What has he done? Verna asked, fearing the answer.
He has somehow taken command of Dahara, and has captured Adendril. He has declared the Midlands alliance dissolved, and demanded the surrender of all lands.
Verna gasped.
It is the Midlands that must fight the Imperial Order. Has he lost his mind? We can't afford to have him bring Dahara and the Midlands to war. He has already done it.
The Midlands isn't going to surrender to him.
From what I gather, Galia and Kelton are already in his fist.
He must be stopped. The Imperial Order is the threat. It is they who must be fought. We can't allow him to start a war in the New World. The diversion could be fatal.
Verna, magic is marbled through the Midlands like a juicy roast. The Imperial Order will steal that roast one slice at a time, as they did the Old World. Timid alliances will balk at starting a conflagration over one slice, and let it go instead. Then the next slice will be taken in the name of appeasement and peace, and then the next, all the while weakening the Midlands and strengthening the Order. While you were gone on your journey, they took all of the Old World in less than 20 years. Richard is a war wizard. It is his instincts that guide him, and everything he has learned and holds dear forge his actions. We have no choice but to trust in him. In the past, the threat was a single individual like Darkin Rall. In this, it is a monolithic threat. Even if we could somehow eliminate Jigang, another would take his place. It is a battle of beliefs, fears, and ambitions of all people, not a single leader. It is much the same as the way people fear the palace. If a leader came to the fore, we could not eliminate the threat by eliminating the leader. The fear would still be in people's heads, and taking their leader would only intensify their belief that they are justified in their fear.
Dear Creator, Verna wrote back, then what are we to do?
There was a pause for a time. As I said, child,
I don't have all the answers, but I can tell you this. In this, the final trial, we all play a part, but it is Richard who is the key. Richard is our leader. I don't agree with all the things he does, but he is the only one who can lead us to victory. If we are to prevail, we must follow him. I am not saying we cannot try to advise and guide him in what we know, but he is a war wizard, and this is the war he was born to fight. Nathan has warned that there is a place in the prophecies called the Great Void. If we end on this fork, he believes that there is nothing beyond for magic, and thus no prophecy illuminating it. Mankind will go off forever into that unknown without magic. Jagang wishes to take the world into that void. Remember this above all else. No matter what, you must remain loyal to Richard. You can talk to him, advise him, reason with him, but you must not fight him. Loyalty to Richard is the only thing keeping Jagang from your mind. Once a dreamwalker has your mind, you are lost to our side.
Verna swallowed. The stylus shook in her hand.
I understand. Is there anything I can do to help? For now, the things I have already told you. You must act quickly. The war has already charged ahead of us. I hear there are Mriswith in Aidendrill.
Verna's eyes opened wide at the last of the message.
Dear Creator, she said aloud, give Richard strength.
Chapter 31. Verna squinted in the light. The sun was just up. She groaned as she rose from the overstuffed chair and stretched her cramped muscles. She had corresponded with the prelate late into the night, and then, too tired to go to her bed, had curled up in the chair and fallen asleep. After Verna had heard about Richard and the Mriswith in Aidendrill, the two had written back and forth about palace business. The prelate answered countless questions Verna asked about the running of the palace, the way things worked and how to handle her advisors, administrators, and other sisters. The lessons Anne imparted were eye-opening. Verna had never realized the extent of palace politics and how nearly every facet of palace life and law revolved around it. A prelate's power was derived in part from making the correct alliances and using duties and power carefully assigned to control opposition. Dividing into factions, responsible for their own niche and given wide leeway in narrowly defined areas, the more influential sisters were diverted from joining in opposition to the prelate. Information was granted or withheld in a carefully controlled process, keeping opposing groups balanced in influence and power. This balance kept the prelate the pivot point and in control of palace objectives. Though the sisters couldn't remove a prelate from office except for treason against the palace and creator, they could mire the workings of the palace in petty bickering and power struggles. The prelate had to control that energy and focus it to worthwhile goals. It seemed that running the palace, doing the creator's work, was really handling personalities and their attendant feelings and sensibilities rather than simply assigning tasks that needed to be done. Verna had never viewed the running of the palace in this way. She had always seen them as one happy family, all intent on the creator's work, running smoothly on direction from the prelate. That, she had learned, had been because of the deft handling of the sisters by the prelate. Because of her, they all worked to a purpose, seeming to Verna to be satisfied with their part in the scheme of things. After the talk with Annalena, Verna felt even more inadequate at her post, but at the same time more prepared to rise to the task. She had never known the vast extent of the prelate's knowledge about the most trivial of palace matters. It was no wonder that Prelate Annalena had made the job look so easy. She was a master at it, a juggler who could keep a dozen balls in the air at once while smiling and patting a novice on the head. Verna rubbed her eyes as she yawned. She had gotten only a few hours' sleep, but she had work to do and couldn't lie about any longer. She tucked the journey book, all its pages wiped clean, back into her belt and headed back to her office, stopping along the way to splash water from the pond on her face. A pair of green ducks swam closer, interested in what she was doing mucking about in their world. They circled about a bit before deciding to preen themselves, apparently content that she had no interest other than to share their water. The sky was a glorious pink and violet in the new day, the air clean and fresh. Though deeply worried about what she had learned, she also felt optimistic. Like everything around her in the light of the new day, she felt as if her mind had been enlightened too. Verna shook the water from her hands as she fretted about how she was going to discover which sisters were sworn to the keeper. Just because the prelate had faith in her and had ordered it, that didn't mean she would succeed.
She sighed and then kissed the prelate's ring, asking the creator to please help her figure out a way.
Verna couldn't wait to tell Warren about the prelate and all the things she had learned in talking with her, but she was heavy-hearted too, because she was going to have to ask him to go into hiding. She didn't know how she was going to manage without him. Maybe if he was able to find a safe place not too far, she could still visit him occasionally and not feel so alone. In her office, Verna smiled when she saw the teetering stacks of waiting reports. She left the doors to the garden open to let in the cool morning air and let out the stale air of her office. She began straightening the reports, shuffling the papers into order and making the stacks straight, lining them up along the edge. For the first time, she was able to see some of the wood of the tabletop. Verna looked up when the door opened. Phoebe and Dulcinea, each carrying more reports in the crook of an arm, both started when they saw her.
"Good morning," Verna said in a bright voice.
"Forgive us, prelate," Dulcinea said. Her penetrating blue eyes caught when she saw the neat stacks of reports.
"We didn't realize the prelate would be at work so early. We didn't mean to interrupt. We can see that you've a lot of work to do. We'll just put these down with the others, if we may."
"Oh, yes, please do," Verna said, holding an inviting hand out toward her desk.
"Leoma and Philippa will be pleased you brought them to me."
"Prelate?" Phoebe said, her round face set in puzzlement.
"Oh, you know what I mean. My advisors, of course, like to make sure the palace runs as smooth as a new greased wheel. Leoma and Philippa fret over the task."
"Task?" Dulcinea asked, her frown growing.
"The reports," Verna said, as if it should be obvious. "They wouldn't want one so new at the job as you two to be undertaking such responsibility. Maybe if you continue to work hard and prove yourselves, I will someday trust you with them. If they think it wise, of course."
Dulcinea's frown darkened.
"What did Philippa say, prelate? What aspect of my experience does she find inadequate?"
Verna shrugged.
"Don't misunderstand me, sister. My advisors haven't derided you in any way. They are most scrupulous about praising you, in fact. It's just that they've made it clear that the reports are important, and have urged me to see to them myself. I'm sure they will come around in a few years and have the confidence to advise me when you are ready."
"Ready for what?" Phoebe asked in bewilderment. Verna waggled her hand toward the stacks of reports.
"Well, it's the duty of the prelate's administrators to read the reports and dispose of them. The prelate only needs to occasionally oversee the disposition to confirm that her administrators are doing a proper job. Since my advisors urged me to handle the reports myself, I assumed it was obvious that they... Well, I'm sure they meant no offense, seeing as how they always compliment the both of you."
Verna clicked her tongue.
"Though they do then go on to remind me that I should handle the reports myself in the best interest of the palace."
Dulcinea stiffened with indignation.
"We already read those reports, every one, to make sure they're in order. We know more about them than anyone. The creator knows I see those reports in my sleep. We know when something is amiss and note it for you, don't we? We bring tallies to your attention when they don't reconcile, don't we? Those two have no business telling you that you must do it yourself."
Verna strolled to a bookshelf, busying herself with a fictitious search for a particular volume.
"I'm sure they only have the best interest of the palace in mind, sister. You being so new at the post and all, I think you read too much into their advice." "I'm as old as Philippa. I have as much experience as she."
"Sister, she made no accusation," Verna said in her most humble tone as she glanced over her shoulder.
"She advised you to handle the reports, didn't she?"
"Well, yes, but..."
"She's wrong. The both of them are wrong."
"They are?" Verna asked, turning away from the bookcase.
"Of course," Dulcinea looked to Phoebe. "We could have those reports, the whole lot of them, worked, ordered, assessed, and ruled on in a matter of a week or two, couldn't we, Sister Phoebe?"
Phoebe lifted her nose.
"I should think we could have it done in under a week. We know more about how to handle those reports than anyone."
Her face flushed as she glanced to Verna.
"Except you, of course, prelate."
"Really? It's a huge responsibility. I wouldn't want to put you in over your heads. You have only been at the jobs a short time. You think you are already seasoned enough?"
Dulcinea huffed. "I should say we are."
She marched to the desk and scooped up a huge stack.
"We'll see about this. You just come and check any we've done, and you'll find you would have handled matters in the exact same manner we do. We know what we're doing, you'll see."
She scowled.
"And those two will see, too."
"Well, if you really think you can handle it, I'm willing to give you a chance. You are my administrators, after all."
"I should say we are.
Dulcinea tilted her head toward the desk. "Phoebe, grab a stack." Phoebe lifted a large column of reports, staggering back a step to keep them balanced.
"I'm sure the prelate has more important matters to attend to than doing work her administrators can just as easily handle."
Verna folded her hands at her belt.
"Well, I did appoint you because I believed in your abilities. I guess it only fair that I allow you to prove them. After all, a prelate's administrators are of vital importance to the running of the palace."
Dulcinea's lips spread in a cunning smile.
"You'll see just how vital we are to helping you, prelate, and so will your advisors."
Verna lifted her eyebrows.
"I'm already impressed, sisters."
"Well, I do have some matters to look into.
What with being so busy with reports, I've not had a chance to check up on my advisors and make sure that they're handling their duties properly. I guess it's about time I did that."
"Yes," Dulcinea said as she followed Phoebe out the door. "I think that would be wise."
Verna let out a huge sigh when the door closed. She had thought she would never see the end of those reports. She gave a mental thank you to Prelate Annalena. She realized she was grinning and straightened her face. Warren didn't answer her knock, and when she peeked into his room, she saw his bed didn't look slept in. Verna winced when she remembered that she had ordered him to the vaults to link up those prophecies. Poor Warren had probably been sleeping with his books, doing as she had commanded. She recalled with shame how she had spoken to him when she had been so angry after her talk with the gravedigger. Now she was relieved and overjoyed to know that the prelate and Nathan were alive, but at the time she had been livid and had taken it out on Warren. Instead of causing a stir, she descended the stairs and corridors without an escort to empty the vaults for her. She thought it would be safer if she were to simply pay a short visit to the vaults on a minor inspection and tell Warren to come to her at their meeting spot by the river. This information was far too dangerous to convey even in the safety of the empty vaults. Maybe Warren could come up with an idea of how they could unmask the Sisters of the Dark. Warren's cleverness was surprising at times. She kissed her ring in an attempt to banish the anguish when she remembered her duty to send him away. She had to get him away at once. With a sad smile, she thought that maybe he could get some wrinkles on his annoyingly smooth face and catch up with her while she remained under the palace's spell. Sister Becky, her pregnancy becoming obvious to all, was lecturing a group of older novices on the intricacies of prophecy. She was pointing out the danger of false prophecy because of forks that had been taken in the past. Once an event in a prophecy had taken place, and if it carried an either-or fork, then the prophecy had been resolved by events. One branch of the fork had proven true, and the other branch then became a false prophecy. The difficulty was that yet other prophecies were linked to each branch. But when they were given, it wasn't yet decided which fork would come to pass. Once resolved, any prophecy linked to the dead branch became false too. But because it was often impossible to determine which fork many prophecies were linked to, the vaults were clogged with this dead wood. Verna moved to the back wall and listened for a time as the novices asked questions. It was frustrating for them to learn the scope of the problems facing one trying to work with prophecy, and how many of the things they asked had no answer. Verna now knew from what Warren had told her that the sisters had even less understanding of the prophecies than they thought. Prophecy was really meant to be interpreted by a wizard whose gift possessed that aptitude. In the last 1,000 years, Nathan was the only wizard they had come across who had the ability to give prophecy. She now knew that he understood them in a way no sister had ever known, except perhaps Prelate Annalena. She now knew that Warren, too, had that latent talent for prophecy. As Sister Becky went on with an explanation of linkage through key events and chronology, Verna quietly moved off toward the back rooms where Warren usually worked, but found them all empty, and their books returned to the shelves. Verna puzzled over where to look next. It had never been difficult to find Warren, but that was because he was almost always in the vaults. Sister Leoma met her as she was returning up the aisles between the long rows of shelves. Her advisor smiled in greeting and bowed her head of long, straight white hair, tied behind with a golden ribbon. Verna detected worry in the creases of her face.
"Good morning, prelate. The Creator's blessing on this new day."
Verna returned the warm smile.
"Thank you, sister. A fine day it is, too. How are the novices doing?"
Leoma glanced off toward the tables with the young women sitting around it in concentration.
"They will make fine sisters. I've been observing the lessons, and there's not an inattentive one in the lot."
Without returning her gaze to Verna, she asked,
"Have you come to find Warren? Verna twisted the ring on her finger. Yes, there were a few matters I thought to ask him to check for me. Have you seen him about?
When Leoma turned back at last, her creases had deepened into true concern.
Verna, I'm afraid Warren is not here.
I see. Well, you know where I could find him. She let out a deep breath.
What I mean, Verna, is that Warren is gone.
Gone? What do you mean, gone? Sister Leoma's gaze drifted away to the shadows among the shelves.
I mean he has left the palace. For good.
Verna's mouth dropped open.
Are you sure?
You must be mistaken. Perhaps you... Leoma smoothed back a wisp of white hair.
Verna, he came to me night before last and told me he was leaving.
Verna wet her lips.
Why didn't he come to me? Why wouldn't he tell the prelate that he was leaving?
Leoma drew her shawl tighter.
Verna, I'm sorry to have to be the one to tell you, but he said you and he had words, and he thought that it would be for the best if he were to leave the palace, for now at least. He made me promise that I wouldn't tell you for a couple of days so he could be away. He didn't want you coming after him.
Coming after him?
Verna's fists tightened.
What makes him think?
Verna's head was spinning, trying to understand and suddenly trying to call back words that were days ago uttered.
But did he say when he would be back? The palace needs his talent. He knows about the books down here. He can't just up and leave.
Leoma glanced away again.
I'm sorry, Verna, but he's gone. He said that he didn't know when or if he would return. He said that he thought it would be for the best, and that you would come to see that too.
Did he say anything else?
She whispered hopefully. She shook her head.
And you just let him go? Didn't you try to stop him?
Verna,
Leoma said in a gentle tone.
Warren had his collar off. You yourself released him from his Radahan. We can't force a wizard to remain at the palace against his will when you've released him. He is a free man. It is his choice, not ours.
It all came over her in an icy wave of tingling dread. She had released him. How could she expect him to remain to help her when she treated him in such a humiliating fashion? He was her friend, and she had dressed him down as if he were a first-year boy. He was not a boy, he was a man, his own man. And now he was gone. Verna forced herself to speak.
Thank you, Leoma, for telling me.
Leoma nodded, and after giving Verna's shoulder a squeeze of reassurance, walked back toward the lessons in the distance. Warren was gone. Reason told her that the Sisters of the Dark might have taken him, but in her heart she could only blame herself. Verna's faltering steps bore her to one of the little rooms, and after the stone door had closed, she sank weakly into a chair. Her head fell into her arms and she began to weep, realizing only now how much Warren had meant to her. Chapter 32 Caelan leaped out of the wagon bed, rolling through the snow when she landed. She sprang to her feet and scrambled toward the shrieks as rocks still crashed down around her, rebounding into the trees on the low side of the narrow trail, snapping branches and thudding into the huge trunks of the old pines. She jammed her back against the side of the wagon.
"Help me!"
she screamed to men already in a dead run toward her. Arriving only seconds after her, they threw themselves up against the wagon, taking up the weight. The man cried out louder.
"Wait, wait, wait!"
It sounded like they were killing him.
"Just hold it there. Don't lift any more."
The half-dozen young soldiers strained to hold the wagon where it was. The rock that had piled down on top had added considerably to the burden.
"Orsk!"
she called out.
"Yes, mistress."
Caelan started. In the darkness, she hadn't seen the big, one-eyed Dahiran soldier standing right behind her.
"Orsk, help them hold the wagon up. Don't lift it. Just hold it still."
She turned to the dark trail behind as Orsk muscled his way in beside the others and clamped his massive hands onto the lower edge of the wagon.
"Zed! Somebody get Zed! Hurry!"
Pushing her long hair back over her wolfhide mantle, Caelan knelt beside the young man under the axle hub. It was too dark to see how badly he was injured, but by his panting grunts, she feared it was serious. She couldn't figure out why he cried out louder when they started to lift the weight off him. Caelan found his hand and took it in both of hers.
"Hold on, Stevens. Help's coming."
She grimaced when he crushed her hand in his grip as he let out a wail. He clutched her hand as if he were hanging from a cliff, and her hand was the only thing keeping him from falling into death's dark grasp. She vowed that she would not take her hand back even if he broke it.
"Forgive me, my queen, for slowing us."
It was an accident. It wasn't your doing. His legs squirmed in the snow. Try to stay still. With her free hand, she brushed hair back from his brow. He quieted a bit at her touch, so she held the hand to the side of his icy face.
Please, Stevens, try to be still. I won't let them put the weight down on you, I promise. We'll get you out from under there in just a moment, and the wizard will set you back to right.
She could feel him nod under her hand. No one near had a torch, and in the feeble moonlight ghosting through the thick branches, she couldn't see what the problem was. It seemed that lifting the wagon caused him more pain than when it was on him. Caitlin heard a horse galloping up and saw a dark figure leap off as the horse skidded to a halt, twisting its head against the pull of the reins. When the man hit the ground, a flame ignited in his upturned stick-like hand, lighting his thin face and a mass of wavy white hair sticking out in disarray.
Zed, hurry!
When Caitlin looked down in the sudden, harsh illumination, she saw the extent of the problem and felt a wave of nausea surge up like a hot hammer. Zed's calm hazel eyes glided over the scene in quick appraisal as he knelt on the other side of Stevens.
The wagon grazed a piling timber holding back the scree, she explained.
The trail was narrow and treacherous, and in the darkness on the curve, they hadn't seen the piling in the snow. The timber must have been old and rotted. When the hub bumped it, the timber snapped, and the beam it had supported tumbled down, allowing a sluice of rock to come down on them. As the rock drove the back of the wagon sideways, the iron rim of the rear wheel caught in a frozen rut beneath the snow, and the spokes of the rear wheel snapped. The hub knocked Stevens from his feet and came down atop him. Caitlin could now see in the light that one of the splintered spokes, jutting from the hub, canted at the end of the broken axle, had impaled the young man. When they tried to hoist the wagon, it lifted him by that spoke, driven at an angle up under his ribs.
"I'm sorry, Caitlin," Zed said.
"What do you mean, you're sorry? You must—" Caitlin realized that although her hand still throbbed, the grip on it had gone slack. She looked down and saw the mask of death. He was now in the spirit's hands. The pall of death sent a shudder through her. She knew what it was to feel the touch of death. She felt it now. She felt it every waking moment. In sleep, it saturated her dreams with its numb touch. Her icy fingers reflexively brushed at her face, trying to wipe away the ever-present tingle, almost like a hair tickling her flesh, but there was never anything there to brush away. It was the teasing touch of magic, of the death spell that she felt. Zed stood, letting the flame float to a torch that a man nearby was holding out, igniting it into wavering flame. While Zed held one hand out as if in command to the wagon, he motioned the men away with his other. They cautiously took their shoulders away, but remained poised to catch the wagon if it suddenly fell again. Zed turned his palm up, and in harmony with his arm's movement, the wagon obediently rose into the air another couple of feet.
"Pull him out," Zed ordered in a somber tone.
The men seized Stevens by his shoulders and hauled him off the spoke. When he was out from under the axle, Zed turned his hand over and allowed the wagon to settle to the ground. A man fell to his knees beside Caitlin.
"It's my fault," he cried in anguish. "I'm sorry. Oh, dear spirits, it's my fault."
Caitlin gripped the driver's coat and urged him to his feet.
"If it's anyone's fault, then I'm to blame. I shouldn't have been trying to make distance in the dark. I should have—" "It's not your fault. It was an accident, that's all."
She turned away, closing her eyes, still hearing the phantoms of his screams. As was their routine, they hadn't used torches so as not to reveal their presence. There was no telling what eyes might see a force of men moving through the passes. While there was no evidence of pursuit, it was foolhardy to be overconfident. Stealth was life.
"Bury him as best you can," Caitlin told the men.
There would be no digging in the frozen ground, but at least they could use the rock from the scree to cover him. His soul was with the spirits and safe now. His suffering was over. Zed asked the officers to get the trail cleared, and then went with the men to find a place to lay Stevens to rest. Amid the mounting noise and activity, Caitlin suddenly remembered Cirilla and climbed back into the wagon bed. Her half-sister was wrapped in a heavy layer of blankets and nestled among piles of gear. Most of the rock had fallen in the back of the wagon, missing her, and the blanket had protected her from the smaller stones the pile of gear didn't stop. It was a wonder that no one had been crushed by one of the larger boulders that had crashed down in the darkness. They had put Cirilla in the wagon instead of the coach, because she was still unconscious,
and they thought that in the wagon they could lay her down so she would be more comfortable. The wagon was probably beyond repair. They would have to put her in the coach now, but it wasn't far. In the bottleneck in the trail, men started gathering, some squeezing past at officers' instructions and moving on into the night, while others brought out axes to cut trees and repair the support wall, while still others were told to throw the small stones and roll the larger rocks from the trail so they could get the coach through. Kaylin was relieved to see that Cirilla was unhurt by any of the rocks, and relieved, too, that she was still in her near-constant stupor. They didn't need Cirilla's screams and cries of terror at the moment. There was work to be done. Kaylin had been riding in the wagon with her in case she happened to wake. After what had been done to her back in Aidendrill, Cirilla panicked at the sight of men, becoming terrified and inconsolable if Kaylin, Addie, or Jebra wasn't there to calm her. In her rare spells of lucidity, Cirilla made Kaylin promise over and over that she would be queen. Cirilla worried for her people and knew that she was in no state to help them. She loved Galea enough to refuse to burden her land with a queen in no condition to lead them. Kaylin had reluctantly assumed the responsibility. Kaylin's half-brother, Prince Harold, wanted nothing to do with a monarchial burden. He was a soldier, as was his and Cirilla's father, King Wyborn. After Cirilla and Harold had been born, Kaylin's mother had taken King Wyborn as her mate, and Kaylin was born. She was born a confessor. The magic of the confessors took precedence over petty matters of royalty. "How is she?" Zed asked, as he tugged his robes off a snag while climbing into the wagon. "The same. She was unhurt by the rockfall." Zed put fingers to her temples for a moment. "There is nothing wrong with her body, but the sickness still holds reign over her mind." He shook his head with a sigh as he rested an arm on his knee. "I wish the gift could cure maladies of the mind." Kaylin saw the frustration in his eyes. She smiled. "Be thankful. If you could, you would never have time to eat." As Zed chuckled, she glanced to the men around the wagon and saw Captain Ryan. She gestured him closer. "Yes, my queen." "How far to Ebenicia?" 4, maybe 6 hours. Zed leaned toward her. "Not a place we want to reach in the dead of the night." Kaylin caught his meaning and nodded. For them to reclaim the crown city of Galea, they had a lot of work to do. The first of it was taking care of the thousands of corpses littering the city. It was not a scene they wanted to encounter in the middle of the night after a hard day's march. She didn't look forward to returning to the site of that slaughter, but it was a place no one would expect to find them, and they could be safe there for a time. From that base, they could begin pulling the Midlands back together. She turned back to Captain Ryan. "Is there anywhere near we can set up camp for the night?" The captain gestured up the road. "The scouts said there's a small upland valley not far ahead. There's an abandoned farm there where Cirilla will be comfortable for the night." She drew a strand of hair back from her face and hooked it behind an ear, noting that Cirilla was no longer referred to as queen. Kaylin was queen now, and Prince Harold had made sure all knew it. "All right, send word ahead then. Get the valley secured and set up camp. Post sentries and scout the area. If the surrounding slopes are deserted and the valley is cut off from view, then let the men have fires, but keep them small." Captain Ryan smiled and tapped a fist to his heart in salute. Fires would be a luxury, and hot food would do the men good. They deserved it after the hard march. They were almost home. Tomorrow they would be there. Then the worst of the work would begin, taking care of the dead and putting Ebenicia back to order. Kaylin would not let the Imperial Order's victory over Ebenicia stand. The Midlands would have the city back, and it would live again to strike back. "Did you take care of Stevens?" she asked the captain. "Zed helped us find a place, and the men are taking care of it. Poor Stevens. He fought all through the battles against the Order when we started with 5,000, saw 4 of every 5 of his companions killed, and he ends up dying in an accident after it's over. I know he would have wanted to die defending the Midlands." "He did," Kaylin said. "It's not over. We won only a battle, though an important one. We are still at war with the Imperial Order, and he was a soldier in that war. He was helping with our effort and died in the line of duty, just as much as those men killed in combat. There is no difference. He died a hero of the Midlands." Captain Ryan stuffed his hands in the pockets of his heavy brown wool coat. "I think the men would appreciate hearing those words, and would find courage in them. Before we move on, could you say something over his grave? It would mean a lot for the men to know their queen will miss him. Kalin smiled.
Of course, Captain. It would be my honor.
Kalin stared after the captain as he moved off to see to things.
I shouldn't have been pushing on after dark.
Zed stroked a reassuring hand along the back of her head.
Accidents can happen in broad daylight. This very likely would have happened in the morning had we stopped sooner, and then it would be blamed on being still half asleep.
I still feel to blame. It just doesn't seem fair.
His smile marked no humor.
Fate does not seek our consent.
Chapter 33. If there were any bodies at the farm, the men had removed them by the time Kalin reached it. They had started a fire in the roughly built hearth, but it hadn't had time to thaw the iron chill from the deserted home. Cirilla was carefully carried to the remains of a straw mattress in a back bedroom. There was another cramped room with two pallets, probably for children, and the main room with a table and little else. By the broken bits of a cupboard and chest and the remains of personal items, Kalin knew the order had been through here on their way to Ebenicia. She wondered again what the men had done with the bodies. She didn't want to find them in the night if she had to go outside to relieve herself. Zed peered around at the room as he rubbed his hands on his stomach.
"How long until dinner is ready?"
he asked in a cheery tone. He wore heavy maroon robes with black sleeves and cowled shoulders. Three rows of silver brocade circled the cuffs of his sleeves. Thicker gold brocade ran around the neck and down the front. The outfit gathered at the waist with a red satin belt set with a gold buckle. Zed hated the flashy accoutrements that Addy had insisted he purchase as a disguise. He preferred his simple robes, but they were long gone, as was his fancy hat with a long feather that he had lost somewhere along the way. Kalin grinned in spite of herself.
"I don't know. What are you cooking?"
"Me? Cook? Well, I suppose."
"Dear spirits, spare us that man's cooking,"
Addy said from the doorway.
"We would be better served to eat bark and bugs."
Addy limped into the room, followed by Jebra the seer, and Ahern the coach driver, who had carried Zed and Addy on their recent journeys. Chandelin, who had accompanied Kalin from the Mud People's village months ago, had departed after Kalin had been with Richard one wondrous night in a place between worlds. He wanted to return to his home and people. She couldn't blame him. She knew what it was to miss friends and loved ones. With Zed and Addy, she felt as if they were almost all together. When Richard caught up with them, then truly they would be all together again. Though it would probably be weeks yet, Kalin still couldn't help being excited by each breath, because each breath brought her one moment closer to having her arms around him.
"My bones do be too old for this weather," Addy said as she crossed the room.
Kalin retrieved a simple wooden chair and dragged it along as she took Addie's arm and walked her to the fire. She put the chair close to the flames and urged the sorceress to sit and warm herself. Unlike Zed's original clothes, Addie's simple flaxen robes, with yellow and red beads sewn at the neck and ancient symbols of her profession, had survived their journey. Zed scowled every time he saw them, thinking it more than a little odd that her simple robes had managed to make the journey and his had been lost. Addie always smiled and said it was a wonder, and insisted that he looked grand in his fine clothes. Kalin suspected she really did like him better in his new outfit. Kalin, too, thought Zed looked grand, though not so wizard-like as his traditional fashion made him look. Wizards of his high rank wore the simplest robes. There was no rank above Zed, first wizard.
"Thank you, child," Addie said, as she warmed her hands near the flames.
"Orsk!" Kalin called. The big man scurried forward. The scar over his missing eye was white in the firelight.
"Yes, mistress."
He stood ready to carry out her instructions. What they might be was of no importance to him, his only concern being that he had a chance to please her.
"There's no pot in here. Could you get us one so we can make some dinner?"
His dark leather uniform creaked as he bowed and turned to hurry from the room. Orsk had been a Dharan soldier from the Imperial Order's camp. He had tried to kill her, and in the struggle she touched him with her power, the magic of the Confessors, destroying forever who he had been and filling him with blind loyalty to her. That blind loyalty and devotion was a wearing presence to Kalin, a constant reminder of what and who she was. She tried not to see the man he had been, a Dharan soldier who had joined with the Imperial Order, one of the killers who had participated in the slaughter of the helpless women and children of Ebenicia. As the Mother Confessor,
She had sworn no mercy on any of the men of the Order, and there had been none. Only Orsk still lived. Though he lived, the man who had fought for the Order was dead. Because of the death spell Zed had cast over her to aid in their escape from Adendrill, few knew Kaelin as the Mother Confessor. Orsk only knew her as his mistress. Zed, of course. Addie, Jebra, Ahern, Chandelin, her half-brother Prince Harold, and Captain Ryan knew her true identity, but everyone else thought the Mother Confessor was dead. The men she had fought with knew her only as their queen. Their memory of her being the Mother Confessor had been confused and muddled into remembering her as Queen Kaelin, no less their leader, but not the Mother Confessor. After snow had been melted, Jebra and Kaelin added beans and bacon, cut up a few sweet roots to toss into the pot, and spooned in some molasses. Zed stood rubbing his hands as he watched the ingredients being added. Kaelin grinned at his childlike eagerness, and from a pack retrieved some hard bread for him. He was pleased and ate the bread while the beans boiled. While dinner cooked, Kaelin thawed leftover soup they had brought in a small pot and took it into Cirilla. She set a candle on a slat she stuck in a crack in the wall and sat on the edge of the bed in the quiet room. She wiped a warm cloth on her half-sister's forehead for a while and was happy to see Cirilla's eyes open. A panicked gaze darted around the dim room. Kaelin grabbed Cirilla's jaw and forced her to look up into her eyes.
"It's me, Kaelin, my sister. You are safe, alone with me. You are safe. Be at ease. Everything is all right."
"Kaelin?"
Cirilla clutched at Kaelin's white fur mantle.
"You promised. You won't go back on your word. You mustn't."
Kaelin smiled. "I promised, and I will keep the promise. I am the Queen of Galea, and will be the queen until the day you wish the crown back."
Cirilla sagged back in relief, still clutching the fur mantle.
"Thank you, my queen."
Kaelin urged her to sit up.
"Come on now, I brought you some warm soup."
Cirilla turned her face from the spoon.
"I'm not hungry."
"If you want me to be the queen, then you must treat me as queen." A questioning frown came to Cirilla's face. Kaelin smiled.
"This is an order from your queen. You will eat the soup." Only then would Cirilla eat. When she had finished it all and had started shaking and crying again, Kaelin hugged her tight until she slipped into a trance-like state, staring blindly up at nothing. Kaelin tucked the heavy blankets tight around her and kissed her forehead. Zed had scrounged up a couple of barrels, a bench, a stool from the barn, and somewhere found another chair. He had asked Prince Harold and Captain Ryan to join Addie, Jebra, Ahern, Orsk, Kaelin, and himself for dinner. They were close to Ebenicia and had to talk about their plans. Everyone crowded around the small table as Kaelin broke up hard bread and Jebra dished out steaming bowls of beans from the pot sitting in the fire. When a sear was finished, she sat down on the short bench beside Kaelin, all the while giving Zed puzzled looks. Prince Harold, a barrel-chested man with a head of long, thick, dark hair, reminded Kaelin of her father. Harold had only that day returned with his scouts from Ebenicia.
"What news have you from your home?"
she asked him. He broke his bread with his thick fingers.
"Well," he sighed, "it was the same as you described it. It doesn't look as if anyone else has been there. I think it'll be safe enough for us there."
"With the Order's army destroyed?"
"The one in this area,"
Kaelin corrected. He conceded the point with a wave of his bread.
"I don't think we'll have any trouble for now. We don't have many men yet, but they're good men, and we have enough to protect the city from up in the passes in the mountains all around, as long as they don't come in numbers like before. Until the Order brings more men, I think we can hold the city."
He gestured toward Zed.
"And we have a wizard."
Zed, busy spooning beans into his mouth, only slowed enough to grunt in agreement. Captain Ryan swallowed a big mouthful of beans.
"Prince Harold is right. We know these mountains. We can defend the city until they bring a large force. By then, maybe we'll have more men joining with us and we can start to move."
Harold dunked his bread in his bowl, scooping up a chunk of bacon.
"Addie, what do you judge our chances of getting help from Nicobarisi?"
"My homeland be in turmoil. When Zed and I were there, we learned that the king be dead. The blood of the fold has moved to seize power, but not all the people be pleased about it. The sorceresses be most displeased. If the blood takes power, those women will be hunted down and killed. I expect them to back the forces in the army who resist the blood."
"With civil war," Zed said, interrupting his speedy spoonwork,
It doesn't bode well for sending troops to aid the Midlands.
Addie sighed.
Zed be right.
Maybe some of the sorceresses could help, Keelan asked. Addie stirred her spoon in her beans.
Maybe.
Keelan looked to her half-brother. But you have troops from other areas you can call in. Harold nodded.
We sure do. At least 60,000 or 70,000. Perhaps as many as 100,000 could be marshaled, though not all of those will be well-trained or well-armed. It'll take time to get them organized, but when we do, then Ibn Issia will be a force to be reckoned with.
We had nearly that many here before,
Captain Ryan reminded them without looking up from his bowl.
And it wasn't enough.
True, Harold said, flourishing his bread.
But that's just for a beginning.
He looked to Kaelin.
You can bring more of the lands together, can't you?
That's our hope, she said.
We must rally the Midlands around us if we're to have a chance. What about Sandaria?
Captain Ryan asked.
Their lances are the best in the Midlands.
And Liffany, Harold said. They make a lot of weapons and know how to use them.
Kaelin picked a soft pinch out of the center of her bread.
Sandaria relies on Kelton for summer grazing for their sheep herds. Liffany buys iron from Kelton and sells them grain. Hersborg relies on Sandaria's wool. I think they all might go where Kelton goes.
Harold stabbed his spoon into his beans.
There were Keltish dead among the ones who attacked Ibn Issia.
And Galeans. Kaelin put the bread in her mouth and chewed for a moment as she watched him clench his spoon as if it were a knife. He glared into his bowl.
There were insurgents and murderers from many lands who joined them, she said after she had swallowed. That does not mean their homelands will. Prince Fyron of Kelton had committed his land to the Imperial Order, but he's dead now. We are not at war with Kelton. They are part of the Midlands. We are at war with the Imperial Order. We need to stand together. If Kelton joins with us, the others will almost have to. But if they go with the Order, then we will have trouble convincing the others to join us. We need to win over Kelton and bond them to us.
I'd bet on Kelton joining with the Order, Ahern said.
Everyone turned his way. He shrugged.
I'm Keltish. I can tell you that they'll go where the crown goes. It's the way of our people. With Fyron dead, then that would make Duchess Lumholtz next in line. She and her husband, the Duke, will go to the side they think will win, no matter who that may be. At least, that's my opinion from what I've heard about her.
That's foolish, Harold threw his spoon down.
As much as I don't trust Keltans, no offense intended, Ahern, and knowing their scheming ways, at the heart of it, they're Midlanders. They may want to grab whatever scrap of a farm lies on a disputed border and call it Keltish, but the people are still Midlanders. The spirit knows that Cirilla and I had our fights, but when it came to trouble, we stood together. Same with our lands. When Dahara attacked last summer, we fought to protect Kelton, despite some of our disagreements. If it means the future of the Midlands, they'll go with us. The Midlands means more than what anyone come new to the crown has to say about it.
Harold snatched up his spoon and waved it at Ahern.
What have you to say about that?
Ahern shrugged.
Nothing, I guess.
Zed's eyes moved between the two men.
We are not here to argue. We are here to fight a war. Speak what you believe, Ahern. You are Keltish, and would know more of it than we.
Ahern scratched his wind-burned face as he thought on Zed's words.
General Baldwin, the commander of all Keltish forces, and his generals, Bradford, Cutter, and Emerson, will go where the crown goes. I don't know the men, I'm just a driver, but I go a lot of places and I hear a lot of talk, and that's what's always said of them. People have a joke that if the queen tossed her crown out the window and it caught on a buck's antlers, the whole of the army would be grazing on grass within a month.
And from the talk you hear, do you really believe this duchess become queen will go with the order, just for a chance at power, if it means breaking with the Midlands? Zed asked.
Ahern shrugged.
It's just my opinion, understand, but I think it would be so.
As Kaelin spooned out a sweet root without looking up, she spoke.
Ahern's right. I know Catherine Lumholtz and her husband the Duke. She will be queen, and even though she takes counsel from her husband, she is of like mind anyway. Prince Fyron would have been king, and I thought he would have stuck with us no matter what, but someone from the Order won him to their side and he betrayed us. I'm sure the Order will make Catherine Lumholtz similar offers. She will see power in those offers.
Harold reached across the table and snatched up some more bread.
If she does, and Ahern's right, then we've lost Kelton. If we've lost Kelton, then we've got the first crack of ruin.
This not be good, Addy observed. Nicobarisi be in trouble. Galia be weakened when so many of her army be killed in Ebenicia, and Kelton be leaning toward the Order, and with her will go a number of lands that be trade partners.
And then there are some of the others who when—
Enough! The quiet, clear ring of authority in Kaelin's voice lowered a pall of silence over the table. She remembered what Richard always said when they were in more trouble than they knew how to wiggle out of. Think of the solution, not the problem. If your mind was filled only with thoughts of why you were going to lose, then you couldn't think of how to win.
Stop telling me why we can't bring the Midlands back together and why we can't win. We already know there are problems. We need to discuss the solutions.
Zed smiled over his spoon.
Well put, Mother Confessor. I think we must have some ideas. For one, there are a number of smaller lands that will remain loyal to the Midlands no matter what. We must gather their representatives in Ebenicia and begin rebuilding the council.
That's right, Kaelin said. They might not be as powerful as Kelton, but there is a quality to numbers that has influence.
Kaelin opened her fur mantle. The crackling fire was warming the room a bit, and the food was warming her belly, but it was worry that was beginning to make her sweat. She couldn't wait for Richard to join them. He would have ideas. Richard never sat around letting events dictate as they would. She watched the others as they bent over their bowls, each with a frown as they pondered their options.
Well, Addy said, as she set her spoon down, I be sure we could get some sorceresses from Nicobarisi to join with us. They would be a powerful aid. While some would refuse to fight, as it be against their convictions, they would not be averse to helping in other ways. None want to see the Blood, or their allies, the Imperial Order, take the Midlands. Most know the terror of times past, and would not want them to come anew.
Good, Kaelin said. That's good. You think you could go there and convince them to join with us? Maybe get some of the regular army to help, too? After all, the Civil War is a part of the larger war, and it would not be going on if at least some didn't want to aid the Midlands.
Addie's completely white eyes regarded Kaelin for a moment.
For something this important, of course I will try.
Kaelin nodded. Thank you, Addy. She looked to the others. What else? Any ideas? Harold rested an elbow on the table as he frowned in thought. He waggled his spoon.
I think if I sent some officers as an official delegation to some of the smaller lands, they could be convinced to send representatives to Ebenicia. Most hold Galia in high regard, and know how the Midlands has protected their freedom. They will come to our aid.
And perhaps, Zed said with a sly smile, if I went to visit this Queen Lumholtz as first wizard, mind you, I could convince her that the Midlands is not without power of its own.
Kaelin knew Catherine Lumholtz, but she didn't want to douse the warm hope of Zed's idea. She was the one, after all, who had said they needed to think of solutions instead of the problems. What held her in the grip of terror was the thought of being the Mother Confessor who lost the Midlands. When dinner was finished, Prince Harold and Captain Ryan went to see to the men. Ahern threw his long coat around his broad shoulders and said he had to check on his team. After they were gone, Zed caught Jebra's arm as she went about helping Kaelin collect the bowls.
Do you want to tell me now what it is you're seeing every time you look my way?
Jebra turned her blue eyes from his gaze and gathered another spoon into her hand with the others.
It's nothing.
I would like to be the judge of that, if you don't mind. She halted and at last looked up at him.
Wings.
Zed lifted an eyebrow.
Wings?
She nodded.
I see you with wings. You see? It makes no sense. It has to be a vision that means nothing. I told you I get those kinds sometimes.
That's it. Just wings.
Jebra fussed with her short, sandy hair.
Well, you are up in the air with these wings, and you are dropped into a huge ball of flame.
The fine wrinkles at the corners of her eyes deepened.
Wizard Zorander, I don't know what it means. It's not an event. You know how my visions work sometimes, but a sense of events. I don't know what they mean all jumbled together like that.
Zed released her arm.
Thank you, Jebra. If you learn anything else, you will tell me?
She nodded.
And at once. We need all the help we can get.
Her eyes sought the floor as she nodded again. Her head tilted toward Kaelin,